You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore, and I'm joined by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
On this rest day, first rest day of the Vuelta a España, we're going to be joined, or I'm going to be joined by Daniel Freeba a little later in this episode. This, of course, is our press conference episode, a regular feature now of our Grand Tour coverage. We answer your questions. You've been ringing them in. We've got quite a few to get through today. We're also going to hear from at least one audio diarist. James Knox has sent us in a load of answers to questions that you've been sending him as well. Nick Schultz, have we heard from Nick today, Lionel?
Not yet, no. Maybe he's having a very relaxing, restful rest day, and who can blame him?
Who can blame him? I mean, if riders are having a relaxing rest day today, it's only after quite an ordeal last night getting from Andorra to Po. There was very bad fog, which slowed down the journey for everybody. A lot of teams got to Po after midnight. But I'm hearing this afternoon that it was a particularly difficult journey for Jumbo-Visma, who organised helicopters, I'm told helicopters plural, for at least their top riders to get from Andorra to Po. And the helicopters had to turn around in the fog. They couldn't fly. So they went back to Andorra, and the Jumbo-Visma riders got in very, very late indeed. And that, of course, includes Primoz Roglic, one of the favourites for the race. Not great for them. I was supposed to interview a couple of their riders today, actually, and it was cancelled at 10 past 2 in the morning when they, at least some of them, arrived. So they'll have been tired today, and others too. I spoke to some of the EF riders. Logan Owen slept through his alarm this morning and missed breakfast. It was a bit, you know, the last few days have been pretty tough on the transfer front. And last night was a five-hour drive for the riders. And some of them could have gone in cars, but they opted mainly to go in the bus because the buses are more comfortable. They can stretch out and stretch the legs a bit, even if it ended up being a bit longer. But not great, is it?
No, just seeing the pictures on social media and hearing your account of what happened up there with the wait for the cable cars to get back down reminded me of last year's Giro d'Italia at Gran Sasso, where it was really chaotic. And there's this real sense that the riders have been pretty much left on their own, left to their own devices to get back down in the cable car, because they weren't able to keep the entrance to the cable car clear enough of members of the public. And I mean, the media, we were all in there trying to get a cable car down. Obviously, we kind of, when riders were coming through, we were giving them priority, but the evacuations from these places sometimes leaves a little to be desired. I mean, there's a sense of, well, it's the same for everybody, a shrug of the shoulders and on we go and just get down as best you can. But putting riders in the cable cars and just when there's so much congestion up there that it then ends up taking hours and hours to get off the mountain after they've raced. And even though it's a rest day the following day, as it was that day, in fact, it's not really good enough, is it? They need to have much better grip on the organisation to give riders the priority to ensure that they get down in as timely a fashion as they possibly can.
Yeah, and there was a problem with the cable cars last night. So the riders did get priority, but they kept breaking down and kept stopping. I don't know why.
Well, because it's one of these things, isn't it? They put pressure on any kind of system, and it goes wrong. And that was a similar case at Gran Sasso. They were, not loading up every time the cable car came up. So it was arriving and then going back down again empty, presumably because of weight limits or what have you, but none of that seemed to have been factored in, and there was nobody from the race organisation on that occasion really getting a hold of the situation and smoothing it out. And it was remarkable how even-tempered and how well the riders took that. But it does seem to be quite a sort of semi-regular occurrence in the mountains. Doesn't necessarily happen so much at the Tour de France, where obviously the infrastructure does seem to be a different level, but yeah, not ideal.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, some of these problems are not easily solved considering where the race goes, but to see the riders queuing up with their bikes to go down in the cable cars was quite remarkable. And they were, you know, spirits were okay. A lot of them were shivering, very cold, and I'm sure some will fall ill after that. But they're pretty stoic, these guys. They endure a lot, obviously, as bike riders. It's the mechanics I felt sorry for, who were getting delivery of the bikes at 1 o'clock in the morning, bikes caked in mud, and having to clean them, presumably, you know, into the wee small hours. But let's not moan too much, Lionel. This is our press conference episode. We've got lots of questions to get through. Shall we hear the first one?
Well, before we hear the first one, Richard, let's just remind everyone listening that if they're looking for something to do on the rest day, they could check out our November theatre tour. And if they want to come and see us live at one of a number of venues around England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and Ireland, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on the live events tab. And come and see us in any of the venues. We're on between November the 11th and November the 30th. We've got a bit of a rest week in between. No rest day for us. We're having a rest week, aren't we? We've got a couple of dates in London. We're also down in Bristol and Cardiff, Worcester, Cambridge, Edinburgh,
Leicester,
Manchester, Dublin and Belfast. And I think that's it.
Leicester.
That's it.
Did you say Cambridge?
I said Cambridge.
Yeah. Tickets going well for most of those venues. So thank you very much, everybody who's coming. We're also doing an event at the Royal Hall in Harrogate during the World Championships, which is pretty close now, September the 27th. That'll be great fun. It'll be myself, Lionel, Francois Tomazo and Daniel Freeb. And we're hoping to sign up a special guest very soon, but tickets are available also from our own website, cyclingpodcast.com. Shall we get on to the first question?
Let's.
Hello, Richard, Daniel, Lionel. My name is Ben, calling from London. Thanks for your great coverage of the Grand Tours, which I always enjoy listening to. I have a question for you, which is not about this year's Vuelta, but it's intrigued me for a while. One of the reasons I first became interested in cycling about 5 or 6 years ago was listening to the interviews with the cyclists. I noticed that they're generally quite eloquent and more erudite and thoughtful than sportsmen from most other sports. For example, it's hard to imagine Wayne Rooney keeping an audio diary of his experience in playing for the England team, whereas you seem quite capable of persuading a number of cyclists to do the same for you. So I wonder if you share the same view, and if so, why you think it is that cyclists tend to be perhaps a bit more eloquent and able to express themselves more with more thoughtfulness than other sportsmen.
Well, thanks for your question, Ben. We shouldn't generalize about either cyclists or other sports people, should we? There are quite a lot of cyclists who are eloquent, and I guess they're the guys we tend to go to for interviews and audio diaries generally. I think there is a culture and in cycling of riders. Is it a culture, or it's hard to tell whether cycling makes people the way they are or whether people who are like that are drawn to cycling, but I think you find in cycling quite a lot of people who can be quite deep thinkers, because I think they spend a lot of time on their own, and if they are deep thinkers, then they spend a lot of that time, I guess, rationalizing what they do and thinking about what they do. And I've spoken about this before, but a lot of mountain climbers are the same, I find. And you know, mountain literature, climbing literature is very rich as a result of that. If you are that way inclined, if you have that sort of brain, you spend a lot of time thinking about what you do. And I suppose, you know, being struck by the irrationality of it, I suppose, and trying to rationalize it. And often those people have very interesting things to say. And I think also that it is a sport where you have to educate yourself in how your body works and how nutrition works and how training works. And so a lot of the guys who do make it to the top are people who have been able to learn these things and put them into practice. And obviously the riders at the very top have gone through all these kind of layers of selection, I suppose. And there are some whose audio diaries would be awful, no doubt. But we are blessed with quite a lot of quite articulate, thoughtful riders who you know help us do our job.
I also think cycling is a sport which does lend itself to the written word and also to being talked about in sort of quite descriptive terms. There's a lot that goes on. It's quite a varied sport. You know, the rider's personal experiences are incredibly vivid, and I think that, you know, a lot of riders that you talk to are able to articulate that in a way. And in a way, I think that the access that the media gets to the riders sort of encourages them to think about how they convey their stories to the public, whether it be, you know, through writing their own blogs or starting their own podcasts or just talking to the journalists on a daily basis at races. Whereas I don't know whether, I can't think of that many other sports that where that relationship is quite so open. You watch football and see them after the game, and they're in very artificial sorts of environments, aren't they, when they do their post-match interviews and stood in front of a board with adverts behind it in a sort of real transactional way. Whereas when we have conversations with them outside the team bus, there is a slightly different feel to that. It's not such a sort of set piece occasion, I think.
No, and often the question is, can you tell us what happened out there, because we've not seen it. And that's not really a question that you have to ask a tennis player or a football player. Although I've just listened to a podcast with Roger Federer speaking to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker. And they do a podcast radio hour, The New Yorker. And you won't get a more sort of intelligent and thoughtful person than David Remnick, nor a more intelligent or thoughtful sports person than Roger Federer. So that's well worth a listen if you've run out of cycling podcasts to listen to. That's really interesting. He's a fascinating athlete, Federer, with a lot of self-knowledge. But yeah, that question, can you tell us what happened, is an open-ended question that can, you know, prompt a very interesting response. And we'll hear later in the episode James Knox's diary from today, where he answers a few questions. And his powers of description and observation are really excellent, you know, and he's well, we've said that a few times, he's doing a great job. So another great installment of his diary. Shall we hear another question, Lionel?
Yeah, another quick one.
Hello, this is Mark Shannon, just back from a walk in the sunshine with my dog Elsie whilst listening to the cycling podcast, which was very enjoyable. I was wondering, for the press conference, with Sam Bennett in the mix at least to win the points jersey at the Vuelta, if he were successful, then that would mean that Bora Hansgrohe had won the points jersey at each of the Grand Tours this year with a different rider each time. That seems like quite an unusual achievement to me if they managed to pull it off. So I was wondering if any team has managed to do that in the past, either win the points jersey at all three Grand Tours with a different rider each time, or do the same thing with the mountain jersey, or even with the general classification. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but maybe I'm missing something obvious. Anyway, thanks very much for the podcast, and hope to hear from you.
Well, hello, Mark and Elsie the dog. Nice to hear you've both been listening to the cycling podcast. It's a question to which I can't give a definitive answer, but I did go back to the turn of the century, the year 2000, and it certainly hasn't happened then in any of that time. No one has won, no team has won the points jersey or the King of the Mountains jersey or the overall classification in any of the Grand Tours in the same year, or if you see what I mean. So no, and no one's really come close either. And I've got to say, I don't think Bora Hansgrohe are going to do it this year either, because I think Sam Bennett will find that the weighting of the points and the way the stages stack up will be make it too hard to accumulate enough points to win. We've already seen that the climbers have sort of rapidly overtaken by racking up points on all of the hilly and mountainous stages. But yeah, one day maybe. I mean, Team Sky certainly, now Team Ineos, of course, certainly, you know, I think it's their ambition to try, and certainly Dave Brailsford's ambition to try and win all three Grand Tours in the same year.
They're a long way from that. I mean, with the roster they have, you would have thought that would be possible, but they've never. I suppose you could say last year they won two out of the three, but they've never come close, have they, really?
Well, two out of the three is not bad, is it? But three out of three, I mean, it just shows how hard that would be. It's not just about the, you know, getting the leaders right. It's about everything else as well, isn't it? Having the right backup, the right support across three races. A real tall order, I think that is. Somebody will probably point out it's been done, but I think, you know, in the kind of the last 20-30 years, you know, we're comparing apples with apples, whereas back in the 60s-70s and so on, you know, the sport was smaller, there were fewer teams, I'd have to look through the record books to see, you know, if anyone has actually done that. But
I think there was one final question you wanted to address before we say goodbye to you, Lionel.
Yeah, Brad Fraumano sent us a message on Facebook asking how we record the podcast when we're not all in the same place, Richard, which happens quite regularly because Daniel doesn't live in the UK, so he's often in a secret location somewhere else in Europe. And during this Vuelta, well, I'm at home, you're out in France, and last week I was in Spain and you were at home. And he just said, how do you make it sound like we're all sitting in the same room together? And the simple answer is, it's all down to the skill of our producers who edit the episodes each night. We record ourselves individually on our fancy Zoom recorders, and then our producer jigsaws the audio files all together and matches them up and makes it sound like we are recording together. We've tried various things. You know, we've tried recording a Skype conversation and various other techniques, but none of them are really give the same sort of audio quality. So we're for now sticking with this method. And yeah, that's how we do it.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our title sponsor. Very grateful to them for their support as ever. And I was, I said in last night's podcast, I was going to watch the latest EF Gone Racing film today, which is about the Leadville mountain bike race. I didn't get around to that because I've had a very busy day. And it did include a visit to the EF Education First team hotel to do a couple of interviews. And on my way there, I listened to some of your questions, and two of them in particular I thought could be better answered by people at that team. So we'll hear now the questions and then we'll hear the answers from the rider Logan Owen, riding his first Grand Tour here, and also from Dr. Rick Morgan, who is the team doctor here. So let's hear first the questions and then from Logan Owen and Rick Morgan.
Hello, this is John Hassel, fan and friend of the podcast. Seeing Mark Soler's reaction when he was called back to help Nairo Quintana today made me wonder what exactly riders are hearing through their earpieces during a race. Is it just their team director and teammates, or are they also plugged into race radio? Also, how often are there technical problems with a rider's communications gear, and how often does a rider in Soler's situation simply pretend there are technical problems? Thanks, and I look forward to your terrific coverage throughout the Vuelta.
Logan Owen, EF Education first pro cycling?
Usually just hear from the directors. Although I think the radios were cutting out quite a bit yesterday, to be honest, just with the weather and the thunderstorms and stuff. But I don't know. Obviously his director said, hey, we want you to sit up. I don't know about the whole show or anything like that. I don't know if that was the right way to go about it. It was a little, in my opinion, a little unprofessional, but I don't know. If your director asks you to do something, I think you just got to respect their opinion and just do it, because they're obviously saying it for a reason. And
complain about it later, maybe.
Exactly. I mean, he's had enough results as a young rider moving up, so I think he can respect the fact that Quintana and all those guys are trying to, he can just focus on the bigger picture, I think.
And people have this idea, I think, that the sports directors are almost sort of controlling the race like a computer game and giving instructions. I mean, I know that, as you say, the radios were breaking up a bit yesterday, but how much of a challenge is it sometimes just to have communication?
Yeah, to be honest, the radios don't really work that well often. So usually the biggest amount of information you get is in the team meeting before the race. They lay out, all right, here's all the points where we need to be in the front, and these are the key sections and all this. And you usually go into the race knowing what you need to do in case the radios give out. So I don't really think, I don't know. We're not really being controlled by the radios, I would say. Like, you're always making calls on the road, and that's what the road captain is for.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is a friend of the podcast, John, here. I've got a quick question about the crash that happened the other day with Aran, Carfi, and Roach. I haven't heard much details about it, and it seems to have had a dramatic effect on GC. Do you know what happened? I heard Tony Martin was involved, someone has a punctured lung, but do you know what happened? Thanks.
Well, thanks for your question, John. It's a question about the big crash that involved Rigoberto Urán, Hugh Carthy, and others. And somebody who knows a lot more about that and the after effects is Dr. Rick Morgan from Team EF Education First. So I'm with him now. Rick, you were talking to me yesterday, actually, about how Urán is. I mean, first of all, do you know what happened in the crash? Do you know what caused the crash?
I don't know exactly what caused it. Asking from the riders, they were coming down a hill at high speed, really good wide road, but I think they came in too fast and somebody had to brake, and then a significant chunk of the peloton went down. Unfortunately for us, about five of our riders went down, including Hugh Carthy and Rigoberto, which had injuries that eliminated them from the race. But I don't know. Yeah, I didn't hear anything specific about what caused the accident. Certainly, it wasn't. I don't know how else to say, but nothing else that I heard specifically. It's just guys going fast.
And the it has been reported that Urán suffered a punctured lung. It's not quite as serious as that you were telling me yesterday, but he's still in the hospital in Barcelona. What's the latest on him?
Yeah. So on a CT scan, they did further evaluation to sort of really evaluate his fractures, and on that CT scan they saw that he had a bruised lung, some cracked ribs, and a very small pneumothorax. So he did have probably more of an air leak than he didn't really have a collapsed lung per se. But sort of out of the, for more caution, they washed him overnight in the intensive care unit. He came out of that fine and was transferred to a normal room where he's been since. The small air leak, the small pneumothorax is not a big concern. They're really waiting for the bruised lung to kind of heal up a little bit, to wait before, mostly because the surgeries he's needing to have is, it's not an emergency, it's something that needs to be done, but they just want to be very cautious about it.
And any idea how long he's going to be in hospital, and what kind of support does he have there? Does he have family there or anyone from the team?
Yeah, I think they're expecting probably to keep an eye on him the next couple days. I think we don't know exactly when the surgery will be planned, but obviously, like I said, it's more elective as far as timing, so they're just being very cautious. But I think anticipating that he'll probably be watched again for a couple days before they do the surgery, and then the surgical recovery will likely be relatively short in hospital, and then he'll have, you know, more of a prolonged recovery to recover from the actual surgery. Rigo is doing well. His wife was able to fly in on Friday, the day after his accident, and other friends have been there with him. In true Rigo fashion, he is joking with the staff. He knows all the nurses' names already, and so he's doing really well.
And the news is a bit better on Hugh Carthy, who came to the start in Andorra yesterday.
Yeah, the start town is not too far from where Hugh lives. And so he came by yesterday. He was discharged from the hospital on Saturday morning. And so his parents happened to be here to watch him race, ultimately. But they were able to bring him up to his residence. And then he came by the start yesterday, and he's doing really well, looking great. So he's already feeling really well, doesn't have any pain, and he's just... you know, going to do the initial phases of recovery, and then he'll start, you know, training again much later. But obviously, timing for these kind of injuries is bad, but Hugh's doing really well.
Well, I've got rid of Lionel, and I've been joined by Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
Had a good rest day?
Yeah.
Full shopping.
First decathlon day of the Vuelta. I'm surprised I haven't come up with this before. Rest days should henceforth be known as decathlon days. So that's where we usually spend rest days, at least a portion of the rest days. And this year, I don't know how much, has this been covered in the podcast? I had everything stolen. I was left with no possessions.
It's been covered. It was in the news roundup.
I got absolutely no sympathy.
There was sympathy. A couple of jokes as well, but a lot of sympathy. Actually, Geoffrey Bouchard, who was off the front yesterday, used to work in decathlon. Did you read Larry Warbass's tweet about that?
No, and Bilal Kadri, who won a stage of the Tour de France in what year? 2014 in the Vosges. I can't remember exactly. Was it Gerard Mer? He currently works in decathlon in Toulouse.
So it's a bit of an AG2R thing going on.
And I think Juan José Cobo, who was recently stripped of the 2011 Vuelta title, has also worked in decathlon.
My goodness me, what incredible knowledge. Well, let's hear our next question. First question for you, Daniel.
Hi, team. It's Claire Knockhath from Leeds again. Thanks very much for your coverage so far of the Volta. It's been really enjoyable and integral because I've not been able to follow much on TV. So you've kept me going with knowing what's going on. I had a question because I was listening to the latest for me, Kilometer Zero on Jan Ulrich, and thinking about Daniel writing his biography, and just wondered, who did you think that you might be writing about in 10, 20 years, about the riders, which riders in the current pro peloton? Maybe someone who is kind of getting towards the end of their career, more established rider, and then maybe someone who's kind of coming up the ranks from the young'uns, who's going to define this particular era of cycling. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you for the question, Claire, and for mentioning the Kilometer Zero on Jan Ulrich, which went out today. It was very good. And, you know, obviously you've done a lot of research into Jan Ulrich, and the lovely rich detail about Frank van den Broek in there as well, and various shenanigans and goings on. So it's a great question. Impossible to know the answer to, really, because as your Jan Ulrich project demonstrates, there's so much more to it than just, you know, who wins the most races. There's a kind of, you know, there's got to be some interest in the subject beyond just winning races. And sometimes that kind of stuff doesn't come to light until later on. But any hunches, Daniel?
Based on yesterday, Pog. Pogacar. Well, we've got this fascinating, tantalising prospect of five riders, really, who in the last year, at varying times, people have predicted are going to dominate the sport and sweep all before them. Mathieu van der Poel, Wout van Aert, Egan Bernal, Remco Evenepoel, and now, since as of yesterday, Tadej Pogacar. Obviously dominate in different ways. I don't think anyone expects Wout van Aert to win the Tour de France, but it has looked over the last few months as though any one of those five could be capable of becoming the next sort of demiurge of international cycling. And you know, who's going to have the most interesting story of those guys? Who's going to be the most successful? Difficult to say. I think Bernal's got a problem in Pogacar. I think what he did yesterday was completely unprecedented as far as mountain stages in major tours at 20 years old.
20 years old, I love that. Bernal's got a problem.
Well, I mean,
Bernal might as well just retire.
He might as well. Game's up, Egan, if you're listening. You go and work in decathlon.
He's past it, isn't he, Bernal?
Yeah, but so it could easily be. It could easily be one of them, I think. Beyond that, I mean, unfortunately, there was a whole spate of riders in the last, well, the last 15, 20 years who have given us, you know, rich material for things that have happened off the bike and unfortunate things that have happened off the bike. And, you know, unfortunately, interlaced with their sporting successes were stories of great intrigue and scandal, which, you know, provided a rich seam for anyone wanting to write a book. But we don't necessarily have that with the current generation or the coming generation.
Or not that we know of at the moment. I mean, it was fascinating listening to the Ulrich Come to Zero, though, because he was a similar phenomenon to Bernal in a way, in winning the Tour at such a young age and everybody assuming that he was going to go on and dominate. And that's kind of where we are with Bernal. And listening to the Ulrich Klum to Zero reminded me that I remember watching the 97 Tour and really thinking this is the next decade. We thought he was the next injury and it didn't happen.
Well, and a lot of people said that at the time. Bernardino said that he thought Ulrich was going to win the next 10 Tours. Imagine that. Imagine if he'd won 10. I mean, maybe Pog is going to win the next 12 Tours de France.
And the thing is, your book wouldn't be as interesting as it is if Ulrich... I know it's going to be really good. But it wouldn't be as interesting had he gone on and won 10 Tours at all.
No. One thing I would also say, as far as books are concerned, I think Matt Rendell's forthcoming book about the second instalment, really, of his... a mini series on Colombian cycling. The first one, Kings of the Mountains, about the sort of riders that were immersed in the 80s, really, wasn't it? The main ones. And the cultural significance of cycling in Colombia, that was brilliant. And I think Matt has got his next instalment coming out in the next few months about the second wave and this more impressive, more successful, more talented wave comprising Bernal, Quintana, Chavez, and so on and so on. So I think that's probably one of the great stories of the last few years, and I'm sure Matt will do a great job of covering it.
Well, speaking of young riders, let's hear from one of our audio diarists, James Knox, who has been busy on the rest day doing the latest instalment of his diary.
Here we are. The first rest day. Made it at last. Currently parked up in bed. Quite drowsy. Can't deny that. It was a late one last night. We got to the hotel at almost 1. And been for a spin on the TT bike round. The course today. It's a tough course. It's a proper UK sporting TT. A bit like some of the old Spoko events that are quite famous around where I am. Quite a nice course, actually. Nice roads. I'm sure they're nice training roads, but it's going to be a tough TT. Have a little talk with the DSs and coach later about what they reckon for me, how to go for it with where I am now, 21st in the rankings. Don't really know what I expected coming into this first day, if you'd asked me at the start. So 21st, not bad, really. Not bad at all. And plenty to build on. So, yeah, a good start to the Vuelta. What else is happening today? We had a nice lunch. Well, we stopped at the end of the ride and I had a nice cafe stop, some cake. Got treated at lunch. We had some scallops. I love scallops. That really hit the spot. I didn't know that was coming, but we get spoiled rotten. So yeah, that was a big treat there. Probably my favorite. Had a good look at some of the questions that people have been firing to me and Nick on Twitter. One of them that I thought I'd give a response to was about how often do I ride without worrying about power and stuff and training. I'd say that's an awful lot. I think the vast majority of training is just ticking over, riding, enjoying it. If you can't do that, then you're having a difficult time. I don't really understand it. Numbers, nor do I really trust them. I've been using a power meter now since 2016, so for three years now. And in that time, through different sponsorship deals with teams, I've had four different brands of Palmeter. And I simply don't trust the numbers to enough to really even worry about it. So most of my best power records are from 2017, I think, just because of the Palmeter I used back then. So for me, really, it's just a sort of training guide. I mean, you get a sort of general idea of what's good, but nothing beats good old fashioned getting out there riding. I quite enjoy Strava, so you can have a proper test on the climb and look at the times. And other than different conditions, nothing really changes that. Someone else is asking about power meters during races and what, you know, how this affects racing. On my Brighton computer that the team uses, I just have time and distance, so not an awful lot of my races measured on power when I'm just looking at how long I've been riding and how far I've done. But this is all personal. I don't want to know the numbers. It's a big, big head crack when you're already suffering. Thing that gets me is you're already suffering because obviously races is, it's hard for a sustained amount of time. And then you'll look down if you have the power meter and you'll look down and you'll see a number that isn't overly exceptional, but it's enough to like go like, why am I suffering so much at X number of watts? And then that's the straw that breaks the camel's back. That's me going, all right, I've had enough of this. Can't do this. So I prefer not to know. I prefer to have absolutely no idea and just ride on the feel because, well, end of the day, it's my job. So I ride my bike enough to have a pretty good inclination of what is sustainable, what isn't sustainable. Yeah. Having a good scan through some of the other questions here, and one of them is about mechanical skills. I've got to say, I'm pretty appalling. I was always so lazy because I've got, well, my dad's a really, really good mechanic. So when I started getting interested in bikes and racing when I was like 16, he always just took care of my bike because, well, it's a bit of a passion of his. And he's also exceptional. I can't really stress that enough. So now when I'm living and taking care of my bike, I do the very, very basics myself, but more often than not, prefer to go to my local bike shop, not have to deal with the stress of battling away, doing some difficult task. And yeah, that's me. Someone asking about smells in the Peloton. Smells in the Peloton, that's a funny one to ask. Quite a lot of farmy smells, you know, as you'd expect, we're outside. The occasional fart, do smell that. It does hit you every now and then. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, especially on the climb. Car fumes, get them. If you're in the wrong place, if you're in the convoy. Here in Spain, there's quite a lot of like, because it's hot as well. I think because it's hot, it seems to really make just stuff rot and smell get blown around a bit as well. So if you go around like pig farms or chicken farms, that can be a bit of a, you have a couple of minutes of nasty smells there, but usually you're riding through it, you're gone, get past it, you move on to some fresh air. So yeah, smells aren't really something too concerning in a race. I'm not sure why anyone would be too curious about what you smell in a race. Oh, you used to be able to smell carbon rims, but gone are those days now with all this disc brake business. So come screeching into a corner and smell the carbon. That's probably the definitive bike racing smell. I'm going to finish this off with what I think is a really nice question, because one of those overlooked parts of the sport, and it's asked, who do I consider the best domestiques in the sport or the best ever? And there's obviously so many. And it's kind of like, well, it's what makes cycling so special, I think. In our team alone, and you know, you get domestiques who are suited to so many different things. GC teams with full climbing domestiques that are GC contenders in their own rights, just lining it out, setting an unbelievable tempo on the front. And one person that, since I've been in the team, I really sort of admire his work is Michael Morco, setting up sprints, lead out man. Just amazing, amazing feeling for the race. I don't know how he does it. He just keeps the boys in the perfect position, waiting. And if they're not there, he doesn't go. And if they are there and there is at the front, he'll launch it. If they're in a bit back, he'll somehow surf onto the right wheel. And yeah, another person on the team, Dries Devenins, work I've seen him doing for Julian this year, setting up classics, setting up classic victories, setting up stage wins in the Tour. Real unsung heroes as well. But I mean, that's the sort of side of cycling that maybe goes unnoticed. I think the real fans know who the great domestics are, and there's so many of them. But yeah, it's a beautiful part of the sport because these guys sacrifice 99 times out of 100 their own opportunities just to work for the leaders. So yeah, and from my own point of view, even it never happened before I'd moved to a World Tour team, but is amazingly. Actually, I mean, I haven't won for a while, so I can't actually talk too much. But wow, the satisfaction from doing your job, doing it right, feeling like you've done it perfectly, and then hearing that your team leader's won is, and the whole sort of team victory, you know, you really, really celebrate together, and it's really special. So, a lot to be said for that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Hello chaps, this is David here calling from the edge of the wonderful Peak District, just on the outskirts of Sheffield in England. A keen cyclist and of course a very keen listener to the Cycling Podcast, whether it's going out for a fell run or on the commute down to London or just helping me get to sleep, which sometimes I wake up to Daniel saying strange things. But anyway, I had a question and it was about the kind of training that the cyclists put in all the way through the season, particularly on the off season. In many sports, for instance, football, a lot of that training would actually be skill-based training, whereas in cycling, we almost always hear about power meters and functional power, etc. It seems to be all on the physicality and a lot less on skill, where actually when you've seen some of the incidences in some of the Grand Tours this year to do with descending, or even someone like G missing a bottle at the top of a climb in the Tour de France, these things could lead to more than incremental gains, perhaps if skills drills were much more a part of cycle training. And I just wonder, are any teams doing that sort of thing? Is there a history of that? Is that an underexplored area in terms of performance improvement? I'd be really interested in your views. Keep up the great work. I love listening to the podcast, particularly as the Grand Tours pattern the summer, beginning, middle, and now sadly end. Really looking forward to the rest of the Vuelta coverage too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sports stuff at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. And thank you to them for helping us out and enabling us to be here. The question there was from David, and it was about skills-based training. It's an interesting one. I mean, obviously, the main emphasis of a cyclist training is on the physical aspect, endurance and sprinting and all the rest of it. But certainly Rod Ellingworth, when he was a coach of the British Academy, put an emphasis also on skills. And I mean road racing skills, like going back to the car to collect bottles. And I think these things perhaps are best learned in races, of course. And I don't know, we talk a lot about sometimes the American riders, for example, may have a problem coming to Europe and adjusting to riding on smaller roads with more road furniture and so on. And the skill of bike handling and being able to position yourself in a bunch and so on, it's undeniably a very important part of racing. Is it something riders can and should work on, Daniel?
I think like you say, Rich, you know, most of the kind of learning and practice is sort of done on the job. I mean, the average pro rider races around, rides about 35,000 kilometres a year, and that's always been the sort of the figure that's what's generally quoted, and that that amounts to about 1,000 hours on the bike. And you know, if you think about Malcolm Gladwell and the sort of, I suppose, quite hotly contested, disputed concept now of 10,000 hours of practice, or it would take 10 seasons riding at the level that a pro does to get those 10,000 hours, to rack up those 10,000 hours. So I think a lot of it is exposure. And you know, does it make that much difference? How often does it make that much difference? How much can you change and affect by tinkering with things like position on the bike? I mean, I think that's probably the main one. And a lot of work does go into that. I think that is sort of that's kind of the germ of almost everything for a lot of professional bike riders. You know, how kind of agile they are, how easily they can move around the bunch. A lot of it is linked to how comfortably they're sitting on, how sort of efficiently they're pedaling on a bike, which is to do with position. And that's definitely not a neglected area. There are other things that teams do, and they certainly, I think, address weaknesses. When's a glaring weakness or a problem with a rider? And then I think they will look towards skills and special kind of coaching and special kind of advice. I remember there's a Spanish guy called Oscar Saiz, who's a specialist in descending, who was kind of recruited and used by what was formerly Rabobank and is now really Jumbo-Visma. So, and that was very skills based. I mean, he had people like Robert Hasing literally riding around cones and you know, the things you'd sort of associate with a cycling proficiency test. So it has been explored to a certain extent, but I've sometimes wondered whether that was the next frontier in sort of marginal gains, and whether we would see, you know, descending and ability to descend and descending specialists become the next hot topic in professional cycling. It hasn't really happened yet.
I think there are also, if like Pogacar might never need to learn how to go back and collect bottles and do that sort of domestique role, Egan Bernal the same, but there are some riders whose job becomes something quite different to, you know, perhaps what they did as a junior and under 23 when they were probably winning races, and that would have earned them a professional contract, and then they become something quite else and they have to learn new skills. I remember when I was in the Cannondale team car a couple of years ago at the Tour, Alberto Bettiol was in the breakaway and he was desperate to stop for a pee. And if you're in a breakaway, you can't really stop for a pee. And he didn't know how to pee on the move. And Ken Van Mark was the sports director, and he was saying this is something he needs to go away and practice, you know? Because, again, you talk about marginal gains, that's something that... you know, he was clearly desperate. He's in a breakaway at the Tour de France. You can't stop to pee. What do you do? He actually did stop to pee and got back on. But had he been able to just slide to the back of the group and ride along peeing, he wouldn't have wasted the energy that he then had to spend getting back on. So there are little skills, little tricks, little hacks that would make life easier. And there are riders who then, you know, become domestiques, and their job is to get bottles or to ride around the group or to help somebody position themselves in the bunch. And those are skills you can definitely work on, although I would think that most of the top-level pros have already developed a lot of those skills just by being there.
Hello, guys. This is Roberto from Colombia, and I want to congratulate you for the great coverage you're doing in the Vuelta. I know for questions for the next press, I want just to ask, what do you think about the design and the layout of the Vuelta this year? Because it has been a very exciting and very eventful Vuelta so far in comparison with the Giro and with the Tour. So I would like to know if this is going to be a deciding factor in the following design of the following years for the Vuelta, because it's really great and looking for the cycling aficionado. So thank you for your great job in the podcast.
Thanks for the question, Roberto. About the course, Any thoughts, Daniel?
No, I think Roberto is absolutely right, and I think the great virtue and advantage of the Vuelta is that it's not tied to a particular mountain range or two particular mountain ranges. Proportionately, I think I'm right in saying Spain is the most mountainous country in Europe. The measure of that, I read this recently, I can't remember exactly what the measure of that is, how that's gauged, but certainly in Spain, there's one of the things that strikes you about traveling around Spain is the number of sort of minor sierras that you've never even heard of, minor ranges that you've never even heard of. And the Vuelta is at liberty to use whichever of those sort of coincide or fit with the route, fit with whichever towns have put up the money to host stages. And consequently, as the race moves around Spain, it can kind of dip in and out of these mountain ranges, so it can have a bit. It can have a bit of mountain stages in the first week, and or in the first part of the first week, the second part of the first week, and so on. Which the Giro and the Tour have not necessarily done, and in the case of the Tour, probably can't really do because the Tour has two huge ranges, a couple of minor ranges: the Massif Central and the Jura and the Vosges. But not that much else in sort of three quarters of the country. So I think, you know, the Vuelta can be, it can really sort of be quite unpredictable. It can have a completely different rhythm to the other races. The Giro is very much tied to the Alps and the Dolomites. You know, there've been races, there've been editions before where they've tried to sort of open people's minds to the fact that actually Italy is incredibly mountainous as well. And in the Apennines, the mountain race that goes all the way down Italy, you can have great stages that are equivalent to the big stages, sort of Gavia Stelvio, Tre Cimini Lavaredo type stages in the Alps and Dolomites. But people didn't really like it. People didn't really get on board with it. Whereas with the Vuelta, I think people accept that there could be mountains at any point in the race, and that's the case with this year's route. And consequently, we don't really know whether the real climax is going to be in the middle of the second week. Has it already happened? Those stages sort of inland from Valencia, was that the equivalent of the big sort of alpine swing in a Tour de France, or is it going to be just before the race reaches Madrid in those last couple of stages? And I think that creates uncertainty among the riders as well. They don't know if they've sort of, if they're over the worst, how much time can be gained or lost in those last few stages. And I think that makes it really exciting and uncertain.
Hi there, this is Andre Hess from Costa Rica. I want to ask what makes a Grand Tour grand. If there was going to be another Grand Tour, a fourth one, which one would have the most potential to be the fourth Grand Tour? And also, which one would you rather like to be the fourth Grand Tour? Which one would be your preference?
Thank you for your question, Andre. Costa Rica, he's listening in Costa Rica. That's brilliant, wonderful that you're listening in Costa Rica. And thanks very much for your question. The fourth Grand Tour, what would be the fourth Grand Tour? We assume that you mean it would have to be 3 weeks long. And well, I don't know what you think, Daniel, but a lot of people are fascinated by the old peace race, behind the Iron Curtain, which went through all the kind of Eastern Bloc countries, and you hear great stories about that race. And you know, perhaps a fourth Grand Tour shouldn't necessarily be restricted to one country, but a region or a continent, and I think that would be fascinating. I mean, what I love about watching some races is seeing a place I don't really know an awful lot about, and as a way of exploring those Eastern European countries, it'd be fascinating. I mean, we watch a bit of the Tour of Slovenia, don't we, now, and we see what a beautiful country that is. Obviously, Croatia as well is a beautiful country. And very mountainous. You could have an amazing race.
Amazing Tour of the Balkans.
Tour of the Balkans, yeah.
Yeah, I think, when you talk about creating a fourth Grand Tour or upgrading something to a fourth Grand Tour, I think the most attractive options are maybe races that don't exist. if one could invent a fourth Grand Tour, you know, I'd have a few suggestions. One would be a tour of northern Spain, or a tour of running from basically the Basque Country and to Galicia and the Atlantic coast, taking in Cantabria, Asturias, and Galicia. I think would be fantastic, and even, you know, Navarra and Rioja, La Rioja. We all look forward to. I think we're all looking forward to getting to those regions in the Vuelta, and we all kind of feel that that's the best part of the Vuelta, and there's every kind of terrain that you would need for a fantastic Grand Tour. Really steep climbs, long climbs.
They've already got the Vuelta.
But that could be potentially fantastic. And like you say, something in the Eastern Bloc, the Balkans. You could have a great tour of Germany. I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I think that 4 days, I think the race is sort of struggling. ASO, who are the organisers now, are sort of almost struggling to sustain a four-day race and to create enough, generate enough interest for a four-day race. But you know, Germany's a country with some big mountains. Would be a lot like the Tour de France in the sense that there are mountains up the eastern side, not quite as big as the Alps or Pyrenees, and then there are the mountains along the bottom, basically, which are the Alps, and there are some big fantastic climbs there, and there would be a lot of relatively flat or rolling stuff for the rest of the race, but that would have a lot of potential, I think.
We haven't mentioned South America, and of course Andre's calling in from Costa Rica. Of course, South America would be amazing. I mean, you know, a 3-week tour of Colombia would be an obvious pick.
Well, let's ask our Colombian listeners, Colombian in particular, what could a 3-week tour of Colombia look like? Which could it cover the whole? Could it cover all of the, you know, the main cities? Could it cover Medellin, Bogota, and Boyacá, and so forth and so on? Would you have to restrict it to one particular part of the country? Like, what? Send us your suggestions for a 3-week tour of Colombia.
Let's see some routes, or just, yeah, across the whole of South America. Maybe a pan South American grand tour would be into Ecuador, Bolivia, you know, a finish in La Paz, the highest capital city in the world. It'd be amazing. As we're speaking, Daniel, Nick Schultz's rest day diary has just dropped. So let's hear from Nick Schultz now. In the meantime, we'll say goodbye to you, Daniel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, guys. Just checking in from the first rest day here in Po. It was a long evening last night. We didn't arrive at the hotel until 12:30. So this morning woke up at about 10 o'clock and had a nice easy breakfast before rolling out for an easy ride just into town centre for a coffee, and then straight back for myself and a couple of the other guys. The time trial's not that important on a personal level, so we didn't bother doing any course recon. We just enjoyed a nice easy day and came back, had some lunch, had a sleep, and then a massage and a little bit of work with the osteo. Heading to dinner soon, but I thought it'd be a good opportunity now to answer a few of the questions that have been coming through on Twitter. So I'll start going through some of those now. There's a question here, which is, when was the last time I went for a bike ride for fun and didn't have to worry about racing, training camps, or power and heart rate numbers, etc.? Well, that happens on a weekly basis. Any recovery ride is zero structure. I can do what I want. I can either ride or have a day off, go as fast or as steady as I want. Obviously, they're as easy as you like, really, and I always make sure I stop for a coffee on those and try and make them a social ride as well. There's one here about muffins. Yeah, some of you may know I'm pretty into my muffins. I've got an Instagram page called Muff Be Good, and time to time I will review a muffin that I eat from any cafe that sort of offers a decent addition. Basically, the attributes are generally I like a big one.
Needs to be moist and have a little bit of a crusty outside, but I'm open to all sorts of flavours. There's one here about mechanical skills. I think that varies greatly amongst riders. I myself worked in a bike shop for 5 or 6 years, so I think I'm on the higher end of the spectrum when it comes to being able to work on my own bike. I think I could do just about anything if I had the tools, so I'm pretty confident, and I like to maintain my training bikes in tip-top condition. There's one here about using power and heart rate monitors in racing, and whether or not or how we use that within the race. Personally, I don't really look at heart rate or power during a race at all. I have the map screen up on my Garmin, so I have the file, the GPX file of the race map put on, and I just look at that, and I've got the race distance and also my power. So the only time I'll probably look at the power there is perhaps if it's been a really hard start and I get dropped, just to sort of gauge whether I'm on a really bad day or if things are probably going to slow down. So just as a bit of a reference point, but I've never once sort of attacked or been in any sort of important scenario of a race where that's played a part. There's one here asking what the weirdest thing I've ever seen a teammate do on a rest day is to aid their recovery. I haven't really seen anything weird. It's just, I think everyone's just trying to maximise the time sideways, laying down in bed and doing as little as possible. So just scrolling through. There's one here about radios. So what kind of information do we receive, and do we think it is useful, or could we live without it or race without it? So on a personal level, I really like having the radio there, basically from a safety perspective. In terms of tactics, there's actually not a great deal of tactical information coming from the car, because what the car gets is always in delay. So if they're watching it on TV or they're listening to the radio tour from the commissaire's car, everything is always behind. So we as the riders, we see what's happening first. And we can make quick decisions and generally good decisions out on the road amongst ourselves. So the radio is just really crucial for giving us a heads up of what's coming. If we're coming into a small town with a bunch of speed bumps or traffic islands, that's actually just priceless in terms of a safety point of view. So I really like the use of it, and I would much prefer having it than not having it. That's a really important one for me, and I hope they don't take race radios away from racing, because from my perspective they don't really play a great deal, a great role in the tactics of what's going on in a race. There's a question here about whether or not we get media training. No, I haven't received any media training, and I don't know anyone that has. Maybe in some teams or some riders they do a little bit of media training, but I think that's sort of what keeps things a little bit exciting when everyone's got a bit of a different approach to how they go about journalists. And personally I like to be honest and frank and just basically say things how they are, and sometimes that comes across well, sometimes it doesn't. But at the end of the day, it's just an easy way to go about it for me. And lastly, there's a question here asking if we have the chance to say, I'm feeling good and I want to really go for the stage today, or whether that's dictated by the team boss or the team leader. That would differ from team to team. And probably actually race to race. So for us, I certainly think that if in the pre-race briefing you had really good legs and you were really on for that day, and you put your hand up and said, look guys, I really want to go for it, I think we're a team where the director would really take that on board, and perhaps create a plan around that. Whereas maybe in other teams, riders don't really have the right to speak up. Although I'm not sure, I don't have much experience, but certainly our team, it's an open forum in the debriefing. We all have a lot to say, and we all chip in and help sort of create the idea of the day. And I think that's what makes it such a comfortable team to be in. So yeah, that wraps up all the questions. Just about brings a close to my rest day. I'm going to head down and have some dinner and then get a big night's sleep before the time trial tomorrow, which I will also consider a semi-easy day before getting stuck back into things on Wednesday. Cheers.
Well, I've been joined by Lionel again to say thank you to a few friends of the podcast. These are special friends of the podcast. You're all special, obviously, but to those who support the podcast a little bit more and in doing so, earn the right to nominate an idea, which we make into a special friend special. And we've chosen our idea for this year, and we're working with the nominee on that. More news on that later. But a big thank you. Lionel, would you like to rattle off a few names of special friends of the podcast?
I will indeed. A very big thank you to Sterling Swaim, Tony Moffa, Simon Tuttle, Reese Newman, John Mettler, Nigel Manson, Phil Martin, Stephen Greer, Jason Moyer, Matthew Ray, and Ryan Clark. Thank you very much.
And from me, a big thank you to Robert Hill, Chris Staples, Tom Begg, William Martino, Michael Derry, Stephen Harris, who won the competition last year to have his idea made into a friend special, Robert Kelly, Mark McBride, Ben Dool, Robert Herold, Timothy Clares, Dave Wedlock, David Cockings. Oh, and sorry, Robert Osborne, Larry Grossman, James Mon, and Tom Naylor. Quite a few names there. But thank you very much to you all for your support of the Cycling Podcast. Become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. And Lionel, thank you very much. I'll maybe catch up with you again tomorrow.
Thank you, Richard. Yes, enjoy the rest of your rest day.
I will. Thank you.